You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday. Oh. August 25th, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live from my apartment for the last time this week. I tested negative this morning. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Noah Colwin, contributing editor at Jewish Currents and co-host of the incredible podcast Blowback, here to discuss his piece in The Baffler on crypto crooks, Tales from the Thrifts. Meanwhile, Biden has officially announced a cancellation of $10,000 of student loan debt for those who earn under $125K. $20,000 for Pell Grant recipients with the same income cap. That means over 40 million Americans will be helped by this. Wish you did 50,000, but this is definitely some relief, or cancel all of it, honestly. Estimates also show that about one half of Latino borrowers will have their entire debts forgiven under this plan. The White House has also placed the DACA program into the federal government's code of regulations, protecting it from legal challenges. That means it's way more insulated from extremist Republican judges and Republican efforts to challenge it in the court. So, great move. Did you know that Ron DeSantis endorsed candidates in local school board races? Well, it paid off. County election results show almost every candidate that he endorsed won, or at least a significant majority. 20 out of the 30 straight up won, and 5 are headed to runoffs. The assault on abortion access continues. 4 states had trigger laws take effect this week. Idaho, North Dakota, Texas, and Tennessee. However, in Idaho, at least temporarily, a federal judge has blocked parts of that law from taking effect. The National Labor Relations Board has sided with Starbucks workers, saying Starbucks illegally withheld wages and benefits for thousands of unionized employees. Let's see that back pay, Howard Schultz. And apparently he has to, on video, record himself saying, "I did something illegal." That's fun. California regulators announced that they will ban the sale of new gasoline cars starting in 2035. In Texas, the Uvalde school police chief, has been fired in a unanimous vote, and his lawyer called it a, quote, unconstitutional public lynching. Yes, the police chief is the victim here. And lastly, 4,500 unionized Columbus, Ohio teachers have ended their strike after reaching an agreement with the local Board of Education. Details are still to come on the agreement. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, everybody. Welcome to the Majority Report and a Majority Report Thursday, although it's been just me all week. Sam returns on Monday. In my COVID journey, I tested yesterday, and I thought it was fully negative. And then I took a little look at it again, and it was just the shadow of a line. So I was like, all right, you know, I got to test tomorrow morning, and then hopefully I can come in on Friday. Negative today. So I'm pumped to be back in the studio. Like, I don't like doing the show from here at all. I feel like I can't see Bradley and Matt. I can't read their facial cues. They're so far away from me. What's up, guys?
Yeah, you're like the guy floating out in space in that David Bowie song. Major Tom.
Planet Earth is blue, I mean, and there's nothing I can do.
That's darker than I actually anticipated, Matt. I guess I am floating out into space with no one beside me. But, you know, it's poetic at the very least. I should be all good by tomorrow. And I'm looking forward to Casual Friday. But today, like, when I saw on the calendar that we have Noah Colwyn on, I'm a huge fan of Blowback. And I'd encourage everybody to check out that podcast. They're doing season 3 now. And that it involves Korea and the Korean War. I've listened to the first episode. I have yet to dive fully into it, but I'm super pumped to talk to him about that and crypto as well in general. But I mean, I can't recommend Blowback highly enough. I think we ran ads for it on the show because it's just that good. So everybody
yeah, and
check
also
out
they're
Blowback.
Paying us, but it was that good.
Well, that too. So on to student debt here. Biden officially announced his plan to relieve student debt yesterday. He'd been teasing this for at least a year at this point and had put student loan repayment on pause for quite a while as his legal teams were working furiously behind the scenes to see if he could do $10,000 or $50,000, when in reality, there's no legal obstacle for him to do any of it. He chose $10,000, I think fairly arbitrarily, but it is something. It's going to be relief for some people. The numbers are significant, with over 40 million Americans who are going to receive at least some relief from this cancellation of $10,000. If you're single and you earn under $125,000 a year, you're eligible for the $10,000 in student debt cancellation. If you marry and you file jointly, it's double that, $250,000. And if you got a Pell Grant, you're a Pell Grant recipient, and you meet those same requirements based on your income, you're also eligible for an extra $10,000 in student debt cancellation. So if you're a Pell Grant recipient who earns less than $125,000 a year, you can get $20,000 of your student debt relieved. And that's the maximum under his current announcement. Mm-hmm. Hopefully this is such a success because it seems targeted a bit politically. I mentioned this and it's not in a bad way, but I'd imagine that the Biden administration is talking about, well, how do we get some more Latino voters? Half of Latino voters will have, or half of the Latino student debt holders will have their debt relieved immediately by this. So that's significant from their perspective electorally.
Yeah, and I just want to jump in. People are saying that we were too negative on it yesterday, and I don't think so. I share Astra Taylor, the strike debt organizer's take on this, which is that, yeah, there is some victory here, and we didn't deny that there's going to be material impact. But there's another victory, which is that a lot of people realize that this is not enough and that more needs to be done. And I'm not, and I make no apologies for being a person who is still saying that actually more needs to be done, and this is a kick the can situation. But
this is not a radical thing. Elizabeth Warren was just quoted saying we should have done $50,000. I mean, that was what she and Schumer were proposing. So, like,
right.
We're not being crazy lefties here, guys. This was the bare minimum and less than what he promised on the campaign trail because he means tested it.
It just objectively was a broken promise. He was saying $10,000 for everybody. This is not $10,000 for everybody.
So, it's still, again, like the picture can be complicated. We don't have to cheerlead and we don't have to completely slam it. I'm in between here, but I do think that the context is important. Private loans, so just so people know, are not eligible. It is the loans, only the loans that are granted by the federal government are going to be eligible under this cancellation, which is a great majority of it. But it's a good reminder that this is the federal government essentially saying, all right, we'll give some of our citizenry a little bit of a break here because they are the creditor in this instance. But here is Biden responding on his way out the door after his announcement on this in a rare, well, they're not super rare, but I like when he gets into this mode where he's combative with reporters and he has some populist instincts in these moments. Like, he was leaving after he concluded his remarks. A reporter asked Biden, basically, is this unfair to people who already paid their student loans? Which is an interesting framing for this topic. And Biden kind of shot back on his way out the door. It's pretty good.
Mr. President, is this unfair to people who paid their student loans or chose not to take out loans?
Is it fair to people who, in fact, do not own multi-billion dollar businesses and see why these guys give them all a tax break? Is that fair? What do you think?
What about people who pay their loans, though, struggle to pay their loans and now others don't have to?
Dark bread.
What a brain dead press corps. What a brain dead press corps.
They're the most credulous people on the planet. I mean, do they? I just wonder if these guys get notes from Fox News before they go in. Like, do all of them just have a binder of what, like, the outnumbered Harris Faulkner group are saying the day of? Like, that's such a stupid question.
It is. It's stupid, but it's also, I mean, not a question that isn't representative of how some people are reacting to this. Like, it is shocking to see some reactions about how one, $10,000 is a bribe for votes.
The takes are crazy.
Sure,
the takes
fine. You know what else was a... Yeah, the takes are crazy. If that's insane. A bribe, so were the COVID relief payments.
Yeah.
So were the payments that Ron DeSantis just gave out that were modeled on that.
Right.
To some... Or modeled on the child tax credit to a specific set of a few thousand families in Florida. Like, yeah, the government does actions and then hopes people that benefit from them vote for them.
Yeah.
And
also...
go ahead. It's worked out pretty well for them with multinational corporations and wealthy people. This is just something for regular folks.
Reporters, yeah. Google farm subsidies, guys. Google farm subsidies.
I mean, if they're so concerned, yeah, let's do reparations for anybody who had to take out a loan to pay for tuition. I'm down for that. We have the governmental wherewithal to do that. If that's really your concern here, let's do that. Because tuition was always a conspiracy against working people to stop them from going to college. I mean, there's a press memo from like the Reagan era. Let's see if I can find it real quick. Basically saying, let's see, I got it here. It is from, this is from Vietnam and Other American Fantasies by Howard Bruce Franklin. Later in 1970, Roger Freeman, a key educational advisor to Nixon, then working for re-election of California Governor Ronald Reagan, spelled out quite precisely what the conservative counterattack was aimed at preventing. Quote, we are in danger of producing an educated proletariat. That's dynamite.
Mm.
We have to be selective over who we allow to go through higher education. If not, we will have a large number of highly trained and unemployed people, end quote. The two most menacing institutional sources of danger described by Freeman were obviously those two great public university systems charging no tuition, the University of California and the City University of New York. Governor Reagan was able to wipe out free tuition at the University of California. This is not some sort of like good faith. Student loan, the system we have, was not some sort of good faith effort by people just trying to get people educated. It was a conspiracy to put youth into debt bondage.
It is a worker discipline mechanism. And to me, it's just shocking that that would be some people's reaction to this, especially when it's at the discretion of the federal government. The federal government is the creditor in this instance. That's no skin off of anybody's back in terms of taxes. This is just a decision made by Biden unilaterally based on his executive power. So really all it is just resentment towards a younger generation from an older generation that went through this, through their college education when it was a lot less costly. And who themselves were, in a way, victims of this same disciplinary tactic that wants a certain class of people to go to to white collar professions, to serve in a particular, to serve capitalism in a particular way. And now they have resentment that the generation behind them might get some relief. They're the same people that want to burn the bridge behind them after they have some success. And now their bosses, now that they're a little bit older, and they're worried that they might have less discipline over the younger people who are coming up the ranks in their profession. That's really all it boils down to.
Yeah, I mean, that's why like there's no concern over the PPP forgiveness, because we're talking about a class of people who understands the function of government is to help them coerce labor. And that's what those giant PPP loans were for. And they didn't even have to go to the actual workers. They could have pocketed that. Like, this is all very transparent when you understand the class interests involved.
Speaking of that, before we get to Noah, I do want to play the Sean Hannity clip. We just mentioned how student debt functions as a way to discipline a working population and coerce students coming out of college to go into professions that might be provide them with a higher earning potential as opposed to, I don't know, becoming a teacher or a social worker or just something that provides them with more freedom. It keeps them indebted to a system that is exploiting them. And Sean Hannity essentially said this out loud on his radio program. He spoke out against Biden's debt forgiveness plan, and he talked about how now some of his staff might get relief. And he didn't say this as a good thing. He said it as a bad thing. I hope that whoever fetched Hannity's coffee in the Fox News offices today added something a little bit of extra, like maybe just a little bit of spit. He might watch out. He should get his coffee himself from now on. Here's Sean Hannity on this program talking about his own employees getting debt relief.
So in other words, what, a bailout plan for rich people to send their kids to school? And what's so bad about working your way through school? Because I did it. And I decided once I got behind a radio microphone, I didn't want to finish my last year or year plus, whatever it was. And I followed my passion, followed my dreams. I never had any hope I'd ever be successful. But when you really think about it, you know, who is going to benefit the most from this? Wall Street Journal editorial board said student loan forgiveness is an inflation expansion act. College costs have soared multiple times the rate of inflation over the last 50 years. And the people that likely will benefit the most are middle class. You know, think about it. You get out of college, you're not making a lot of money. We have a lot of young people that work on my TV show. They're not making 125 grand. They're now eligible to get, in some cases, up to 20,000, in other cases, 10,000. And this is New Green Deal radical socialism. This is the push for, oh, we're going to incentivize. They're actually telling poor people that they should go into debt so they can get their solar panels. How stupid is that? It's insane. Anyway, this is very perverse incentives, and this is a reckless economic decision on every single level. And the student debt loan forgiveness, I am telling you, colleges are loaded. They are rich. They are making phenomenal amounts of money. Their endowments are massive. They're just huge. Anyway.
I made a series of completely incongruent points, but no, the Biden administration is not compelling poor people to buy solar panels. The Inflation Reduction Act has tax credits if you choose to put solar panels on your home or use a pump that would have less energy, be less energy intensive. It's a incentive. It's a choice. They're not compelling poor people. As opposed to this, which is blanket relief for, there are poor people who took out loans, actually mostly poor and middle class people who took out loans to go to college.
Only rich people don't take out loans. Exactly.
Yes. Rich kids don't take out loans. That's the whole point. It's really common sense to think about it that way. But I was just amazed by how he brought his own employees into it there, which
they should unionize.
They should, after they spit in his coffee. But like, I mean, can you imagine hearing that? hearing your boss on his radio program essentially say it's a bad thing that my employees have less financial pressure on them right now, that's how much of a psycho this dude is.
I can imagine Sam saying it, but I think it may be a joke.
Yeah, right? What he says there, though, is more of... Is the mentality of these bosses, and it's indicative of it, more than I think people want to think, and more than most people would say out loud, but Sean Hannity did, which is that my employees now might benefit from this, and they will be less compelled to stay under my control. I'll have less coercive power, and I will be able to discipline them less. And they won't be able to stand up to me. They will have more freedom. Like, he essentially says, look, I worked my way up. I have no idea what his situation is with his student debt. I wouldn't be shocked if he came from a wealthier family and he got, you know, benefits there. But I have no idea, right? But there is this belief that debt is something that you have to go through because it makes you a righteous employee by my standards. And then you do it to the generation behind you. That's how it works.
Yeah. When in fact, debt is just a controlling mechanism. So rich people get interest instead of just tax to pay for public goods. I mean, it's funny, the solar panel example, because it's true that I could see the Democrats having a system where rich people are trying to finance their own green energy. Because the other side completely denies green energy needs is a need. And so you have just corporate Democrats as the ones in charge of doing it. But what we should be doing for poor people, to be clear, is grants. They shouldn't have to pay back this stuff. The government should just be providing it. And there shouldn't be no banker collecting interest on whether it's education or our need to green our energy.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be joined by Noah Colwin. We are back, and we are joined now by Noah Colwin, who is the co-host of the incredible podcast Blowback, contributing editor at Jewish Currents, and author of this piece in The Baffler on crypto crooks called Tales from the Thrifts. Noah, thanks so much for being here today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
I mentioned this to the audience at the start of the show that I love Blowback, and I want to talk about the latest season towards the end of the show. But this piece that you wrote on crypto made a comparison between the SNL crash of the 80s and kind of like the frenzied cash grab of crypto in 2022, which I thought I'd never put that together, but it just was really apt and well said. Let's, I guess, start with talking about the SNL crash and setting up that context for people, savings and loan crisis of the 80s and 90s. What happened there? And we can walk through that and then talk about how it fits into the current crypto climate.
Sure. So thanks for having me on.
Yeah. Ooh.
I'm sorry, I couldn't tell. I thought I was muted for a second. No, thanks for having me on. So, and thank you for the kind words. And I guess the thing that I, you know, would want to kind of emphasize at the outset is that the idea that I had going into writing this essay was basically to sort of see if I could find a way of explaining what I thought was wrong with everything in crypto, Web3, Bitcoin, you know, the sort of new melange of, you know, financial and tech products that have come out. Largely unregulated or semi-regulated. And what I wanted to try and do was find a way to explain what I thought the significance of these things were or was, and, you know, how it came about, how, you know, like, how does something like this happen? And to do so without really engaging in, like, you know, trying to assess the technical premises, of, you know, things in crypto, because I think that it is on the whole become fairly distracting. And, you know, as a premise, it's just sort of like, I think it obstructs a lot of clear thinking on the subject. So for me, it was kind of thinking, you know, well, all right, then what are the, you know, existing, what are, you know, what are these scandals that have happened in recent American history? Or at the very least, you know, what are, you know, what is another thing that I could look at to at least compare crypto to? You know, what can, what are things that it has in common with other previous phenomena in American political economic history? And the savings and loan crisis in the savings and loan banks, I don't think would necessarily, I don't think you're crazy for not thinking of the comparison, because I don't think it would scan with a lot of people. These were, you know, if you've seen like It's a Wonderful Life, you know, this is what you think of as George Bailey, and it's a, you know,
that
sort
was my
of
first crazy, thought. I'm in,
exactly,
you know,
and you know, right. It's a thrift is the other name for a savings and loan bank. It projects an image of conservatism, and that's because the business that they were in was largely giving out residential loans and having, you know, very, very, like they couldn't really invest the money that they were collecting except in, you know, advancing mortgages, basically. And it was a pretty tidy and conservative business, except by the, you know, the 60s, it started to really consolidate like crazy. And then in the 70s is when it started, deregulation became sort of the answer to the structural problems that were facing the thrift industry. Because at that time, when inflation started to hit, you know, and much like we're confronting inflation now, the, you know, if you're a savings bank and your money is sitting away in a certificate of deposit and you can't pull out your money because, you know, it's you'll take a penalty. Well, it turns out a lot of people were taking the money and pulling, you know, wanted to pull out their certificates of deposit anyway, because they could get better returns in new products that were being created through other, you know, policy changes like money market mutual funds, for example. So in this competitive financial landscape, they got an effective bailout first under Carter and then under Reagan. And, you know, the savings and loan banks were not, again, they were not like, yes, you had maybe like individually solvent institutions, but the structure of the industry, which was run and overseen by a federal bank board specifically dedicated to these types of banks, you know, they were able basically to keep, you know, sort of like Calvin and Hobbes, and how Calvin, rather than cleaning up his room, will just, you know, honestly will just stuff everything in the closet, and then his mom opens it and it all comes tumbling out. Like that was, you know, basically what they did. And it blew up at the end of the 80s, basically right after, like, it's the savings and loan crisis cleaned up just in time, you know, like literally after George H.W. Bush is elected. And that's when it's like they, you know, they passed what's called FIREA. And this is stuff that's not necessarily my piece, but just to give a sort of, you yeah. know, kind of explain why I thought to connect these two things in the first place. The, you know, Bush era financial reform is ultimately what, you know, is organizes the structure of the bailout to fix the SNL problem. And it ends up costing, you know, estimates put it, you know, over $100 billion. So this is a staggering amount of money. And, you know, and it's a, you know, these are, I mean, this is money that was supposed to be invested in like, you know, commercial and residential real estate, you know, growing America and the amount of habitable America, so to speak. And instead, you know, you had bank regulators with, you know, watching videotapes in horror of buildings wasting away. And it's this like sort of great, you know, example of, you know, just like how in the Great Depression, right, you had, you know, livestock being slaughtered in the middle of the country while people were going hungry on the East Coast. You had, you know, the savings and loan crisis was in a sense like one of the ways that I think people are, you know, they think of it as like these, you know, weird bank failures of the 1980s. But in effect, it was a, you know, a kind of way to effect a similar kind of wealth transfer, a similar kind of contradiction mm-hmm. using money that should have gone to, you know, improve the lives of people and, you know, be productive commerce. And instead, you know, I think if you were then to fast forward, you know, a couple decades, we arrive at a similar kind of moment where you have, you know, the crypto, you know, dream, so to speak, as defined by the industry leaders, and I particularly focus on Sam Bankman-Fried, is that basically they're creating like an alternative monetary system that is, you know, really more than anything has so far been about being able to deliver, you know, like fixed and stable returns to investors. You know, like they're basically creating bonds out of crypto. And you know, if they're able, like, they're like, it seems like the goal is that if they like psyop enough people and convince them that crypto is real, that they will get enough momentum to save themselves. And that, for what it's worth, is also what a lot of the SNLs thought. And this is where you get into the case of, well, like, well, what is it then that sustains both of these delusions, both the crypto delusion and then also the, you know, the delusion of the SNL people. And it was basically political influence. The SNL crisis, like the Keating Five, which almost took down John McCain, the resignation of Democratic Speaker Jim Wright, there, you know, these and many, many other scandals were huge issues in the SNL crisis, even if they are not remembered as such today. And, you know, today, I mean, Sam Bankman-Fried, the crypto lobby is aggressively, you know, representing itself as such, whether it's the Andreessen Horowitz people who are invested in crypto, wage and culture war, you know, but more concretely, you have people like Sam Bankman-Fried who want to influence Democratic politics. And so that to me is kind of like the big story, is that at an age when, you know, clearly we need in capital to go into these, you know, really necessary capital intensive fields to, you know, prepare for, you know, a future that has to be decarbonized and you know, has to rely on less exploitative labor and so on. Instead, we're literally, you know, investing it in bullshit. And that is able to, you know, I mean, satisfy the interests of, I guess, a very limited number of people for a short amount of time.
And also presenting the bullshit that we are investing in as a bond in that it has some sort of like stable underpinning, when in fact the reality of crypto is that it's the most unstable, you could call it a derivative trading, which I think was apt when you wrote about it in your piece, but it's as unstable as it possibly can get as an underlying asset.
Right. Like, and you know, derivatives exist for a reason, which is that if you want to accommodate fluctuations in price or value and to hedge a bet, basically, you need derivatives, you know, which is basically, you know, functionally, it's a financial product of any kind that operates on the premise of if X, then Y. So, you know, if you're buying a futures contract that says, you know, I'm betting that the price of beef is going to go up this amount or is going to go down this amount. Sorry. That's a way to hedge a bet, you know, in the event that like you end up shipping a bunch of beef somewhere. And by the time it gets there, it's not remunerative enough for you. Aha, you've offset it by buying this contract. You know, finance is the art of finding other ways in which, you know, putting money in places and on terms like that, you know, can develop, you know, theoretically. And in the case of crypto, derivatives, I think, basically, you know, they serve a kind of, you know, dual function in that they add a layer of complexity, in that they're a barrier between saying this is what the underlying thing is and this is what our product is. And that barrier is the, you know, the idea that like the derivative has some sort of, you know, special sauce, whether it's an algorithm or some kind of, you know, accommodation for movements based on some sort of, you know, like strategy that obviously, because again, it's crypto, is not really, does not have to be defined by any externally sound terms.
But sorry to cut you off there, but that is the technicality that getting lost in that kind of, the technical terms of what crypto is and the algorithm as this ethereal, godly thing that is bestowed upon the cryptocurrency market, it deliberately hides the ball because it makes it seem like the underlying asset is something that is determined scientifically in the way that, say, I don't know, like the mortgage market or the housing market is, or other things where the assets were a bit less risky, and that's what this kind of trading is designed to, in theory, is designed to yield. But that's not the reality in this instance because it's incredibly volatile.
No. It's very, I think in a lot of derivatives, especially after the financial crisis, there, you know, there was a major wave of regulation through Dodd-Frank, and a lot of, you know, there's been some reporting to the effect that the wave of regulation from that has in some measure insulated banks from, you know, getting too deep into crypto. At the same time though, you know, like, if you listen to the interviews of the executives of companies, like the guy who runs the company behind USDC, which is one of the biggest stable coins, supposedly these, you know, bond-like entities that allow people to collect a yield on their crypto while also allowing them convertibility in and out of various cryptocurrencies. The head of one of those companies was, you know, telling Bloomberg, I heard him yesterday talking about how it's like, oh yeah, our investors include Fidelity and other sort of large private equity or asset managers, BlackRock, I think. And so, you know, there's a way in which part of what the whole crypto thing to me then sort of becomes is like, all right, well, if the product is itself not like the point, like what is, and it seems to me that it's like, well, it's really just about making sure that like, if there are returns, like if there are gains to be had here, that like these guys, these major players who already, you know, along with Vanguard and State Street and others, State Street and others, control so much of, you know, the outstanding shares of the public market, that they are, you know, that they are going to be baking this in. And, you know, thus that means that they have exposure. And so that thus when this stuff inevitably goes to zero, because it turns out that a decentralized network ultimately is subordinate to state authority, whether or not you like it. It's really like we don't know how much that unlike the SNL, you know, crisis, which at least had a federal regulator monitoring it this every step of the way. We are still dealing with like, you know, the SEC against, you know, tremendous pressure, it looks like, is fighting tooth and nail to even sort of get like a basic idea of what's going on here. You have crypto companies, you know, standing up to the Treasury Department saying that they don't want to comply with money laundering laws. I mean, you know, it's a very that's the case with Tether specifically. I mean, this is a very I would call it a brave new world, but that's sort of in the case, like, you know, if not in this particular thing, I think we've been dealing with sort of like norm shattering of that variety for a few years going now.
Well, so the savings and loan crisis too is distinct in that they did have to deal with regulators, but this was a part of like their deregulation process, which ended up creating the crash. But at the same time, they also were bailed out and were working in tandem, right? With was it the Carter administration that gave them money as a way to help them from sinking?
So it starts with the Carter administration. I mean, yeah. It's easier, I think, to think of the SNL lobby. It's not so much in the 70s a federal force until like there's this. They have this major lobby that is a federal force called the U.S. League and was a big spend. But it's not so. The big, like the more pivotal moment for there as like a national political force comes in the early 80s once Reagan is put into office. But, you know, in general, like even though like Washington is where they were leveraging their force at that moment in the early 1980s, part of what characterizes SNLs is that they really are, they represent regional power. And in the case of specifically what kind of regional power, the Sun Belt, most importantly in Texas and California, but also in, you know, Colorado, Arizona, and other states that are part of, you know, the, you know, kind of power shift that is taking place in the country at that moment. The deindustrialization of the Midwest, and the East and Mid-Atlantic, that then begins to favor, you know, the shifting nature of the American economy begins to favor these, you know, low-tax growth states in the South and West. And the savings and loan, you know, composed of local, you know, business owners in these places a lot of the time, the deregulation that their industry lobbies for, ultimately, you know, it makes them subject to what one former regulator of theirs called control fraud, which is a variety of white collar crime where, like, people take control of a business in order to destroy it. So it's kind of like the bar from Goodfellas when they busted out. It's, you know, that's basically what a control fraud is. Like private equity kind of does that, but like, you know, there has to be something left at the end for a private equity bust out often to work. Like, you know, in the case of Toys R Us, for example, like there's IP at the end of that, and so it can be reanimated. But like, obviously, that's not really how, you know, the bust out bar in Goodfellas can work, and it's not how an SNL bank could work. It had to die at the end. And the regulators were basically, you know, were ultimately it became the question of like either people who tried to deal with it seriously, which would have inevitably meant like, you know, seriously winding down or fundamentally changing these banks, or like, you know, or it was basically, you know, were you on the the industry's, you know, payroll implicitly or explicitly. And a lot of senators and a lot of people, I mean, these people were the biggest donors in Washington in the early 1980s, just by raw numbers. And, you know, they were real estate developers and mortgage lenders all in one. And the Keating Five scandal is sort of the apex of this, when Charlie Keating, a poor anti-pornography activist whose bank was instrumental in helping prop up Michael Milken, he openly tried to bribe a bunch of members of Congress, including John McCain. And it's like, you know, basically by like, you know, the skin of his teeth and their skins of those people's teeth that like they didn't get indicted and really more formally screwed. So, you know, the crypto thing is sort of, to me, like, can this take on, like, it's already to me taken on like financial dimensions far more significant than the SNL crisis did, just because of how vast the crypto retail infrastructure is. And also, you know, like the scale of the world is bigger and the scale of digital financial economy is bigger than the, you know, SNL market was at that time. The difference is like, you know, can the crypto people as an organized lobby convert that into a political effort that, you know, is able to preserve that there is a bailout of some kind? Because, you know, right now the SEC is saying there will be no bailout, but you know, that is the buck does not stop with the commissioner of the SEC in this country. It stops
and
with the
also,
president, and it could get a lot worse there.
The crypto industry has now, despite, you know, thumbing its nose at the regulators for a while, they've been ramping up their lobbying efforts and their financial donations to a lot of different senators, representatives, parties, et cetera. So perhaps they're trying to copy and paste from past, you know, financial lobbying efforts as well. I guess I am curious here, though, like, I'm surprised I don't really know this, but the fact that the Standard and Loans banks, that they were basically the reins were taken off and they were able to take more risky bets, which ended up crashing the banks within a few years after they were allowed to do that, and it bottomed out. Was that seen as for when Glass-Steagall was repealed? Like, was there any understanding that copying something that ended up bottoming out when it came to these kinds of SNL banks, like, and putting it more on a national scale, would that make it even riskier? Was there an understanding that doing that was just doubling down on helping out these financial institutions and making them even riskier and more detrimental to the country?
So, you know, it's a very good question. I think that, like, there, it was not the answer is that no, it was not clear to the country at the time what any of it, I think, really would amount to, for a couple of reasons. The first of which is, this legislation there was a lot going on, is the short answer. The Garn-Saint-Germain Act, which was signed in 1982, that was the effective reorientation of the SNLs. It was the thing that really unshackled them and allowed them to make a lot of speculative investments, particularly in commercial real estate and construction. And what that, you know, that basically allowed them to become really effective conduits for federally guaranteed money laundering, meaning that, like, you could run a lot of really, you know, you could basically, if you ran an SNL, collect money from, let's say, Merrill Lynch, which would pay you a fee and say, like, I will give you $1 million in deposits for your bank from this pension group in, you know, this group of this union pension fund, and you will get a kickback, I get a kickback, and the issue is that, like, you know, and you'll get a bunch of money. The issue is that, like, we're going to have to offer them and pay them a lot of yield, you know, so that they have an incentive to keep this money with us. And that sort of loosening of restrictions on allocating capital like that, both on how it goes to the firm, you know, how it goes to the bank, and then how it was allocated to firms or to projects or on whatever basis. Oftentimes it was just, you know, used, you know, by senior executives at the bank as their own, you know, piggy bank. Or it was, you know, sent into, you know, favored projects of friends that were often failed. There was a lot of drug trafficking that was connected to SNL banks and, you know,
well, they have that networks. In common with crypto as well, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and this is where it's sort of, you know, I didn't really even dwell on that dimension of it because I think it would have been a little bit boiling the ocean. But, you know, it's very, I think to me, the idea that like, you know, like alternative form, part of what it really speaks to is that like what you're really talking about when you're talking about like unregulated money or the dream of unregulated money is that you were talking about, you know, creating space for money laundering and drug trafficking and so on, not as like, you know, in contravention of state policy, but as a product of state policy. And so if you end up permitting something like crypto to go on, like if you allow these things to operate in the fashion that these services claim they need to in order to function, then they get all of the privileges of banks with none of the responsibilities. And, you know,
but it's marketed as cool. LeBron James is a crypto enthusiast. So is Tom Brady. So that is something I want to touch on.
It's, you know, I would say it's distressing, but I also think it's such a marvelous explanation of like, yeah, like nobody has an idea of like, you know, if you bury anything under enough levels of, you know, just like, you know, aggressive emotional programming, whether it's, you know, using, you
and
know,
technical parlance.
Yeah. I mean, like whether it's like, you know, empowerment stuff, like, you know, like be bold, lose all your money or, you know, you like, you know, like it's about diversity and equity or something, which now like scans has been all the many people, but is, you know, in the minds of the people marketing this stuff, very important to like how they're able to justify it, to themselves and to the people who give them money. You know, I mean, it's very, yeah, it's terrifying. And look, the SNL is like, they also, you know, had to manufacture consent for themselves, right? Like the first ever sports naming right deal of the modern era was at the Forum in Los Angeles, was the Great Western Savings Forum in the days of Magic Johnson. You know, they really had to actively go, you know, like part of this is marketing their deposits. No, like you have to, like if you have a retail operation in some measure and you're trying to collect deposits and stuff like that, then, you know, you have to get your name out there. But moreover, it also is like, you know, it affirms your legitimacy. You know, there's a great, you know, LA was probably a really good example for the exorbitant spending of a lot of these entities. Columbia Savings and Loan, which is another Michael Milken collaborator.
MSG.
right. They built a huge office in Wilshire that cost something like tens of millions of dollars. You know,
which was the SNL marketing ploy at Madison Square Garden? I'm blanking on this.
Oh, well, so that was Washington. That was actually the carcass. So, like, when the SNLs were basically killed off in the 90s, they became a lot of them mutual, what are called mutual savings banks. And those became, you still see some of them exist, but, like, the biggest of them was the shadow bank, or at least, you know, kind of shadow bank, but it was, like, the, you know, corporate descendant by like a decade or two of Great Western, Washington Mutual, which is one of the worst offenders of the financial crisis. And Washington Mutual also bought naming rights to a basketball arena. And of course, you know, if history repeats itself twice versus tragedy, then as farce, then it was the Great Western Forum for the LA Lakers. And it was the Washington Mutual Forum Theater for the Madison Square Garden Knicks.
Ah, well, I mean, so that brings me to another comparison between the savings and loan banks and the crypto industry, which is the fact that it is aggressive in its marketing towards quote unquote Main Street and bringing in regular people in your incredibly dangerous and risky scheme and for the wealthiest involved to make money. Cryptocurrency is we understand it's like a Ponzi scheme. It's a multi-level marketing scheme. And the people who are going to be making the most money from this are the people who got in really early and bought a bunch of bulk of cryptocurrency. And it doesn't matter what coin you're using. It is the same every step of the way. What were some of those comparisons in the sense that this was both seemed to me a really direct way to rip off regular people through almost direct marketing schemes.
Right. I mean, that's a really good way of putting it. You know, social media is functionally a platform for direct marketing schemes more than anything else. It's just the only, like, it's the only way to privately administer something like the internet is that it just in the end becomes like kind of this sort of like the arc of the internet is just the proliferation of direct marketing schemes under one guise or another, subsidized by investors until they are able to achieve escape velocity in one way or another. See Amazon, for example. But I guess, you know, in the case of crypto, you know, weighed against SNL, the one thing that like is a really important point of departure between the two, I would say, in that regard, actually, is that the SNLs, you know, were this, they benefited from having a tidy, stable reputation, you know, pillars of the communities, like your local anti-communist zealot. He may have run an SNL. It was not considered a place for, you know, volatile, you know, like, you know, I think like the perspective, the popular sentiment would not have thought of SNLs as, you know, the kind of place of any sort of financial ingenuity, you know, chicanery or legitimate.
In fact, it was probably marketed as the opposite or thought of as the opposite just based on its initial construction, which rapidly changed in the 80s.
Yes, yes, yes. And I think that the other way to think about it then with crypto is that it's like, well, in the case of crypto, you know, crypto comes about and emerges in what, you know, a lot of people now call like the zero interest rate period. And that refers to the fact that, like, since the financial crisis, we had, you know, like, credit was, you know, close to free if you were able to access it. Meaning, you know, if you were the kind of person able to open lines of credit, borrow, you know, like, you know, for credit cards, auto loans, home financing, et cetera. And now that we are seeing interest rates tighten, you know, in that zero interest rate period, we now, I mean, to me, crypto is just sort of a way of like, yeah, it is only explicable as an investor phenomenon when you are looking for things to, for investors, you know, like people who represent big institutional investors, hedge funds, pension funds, you know, when they are looking for things to invest in and they're not seeing anything that says, well, you know, oh, well, this will give me enough return. Because if every stock is delivered, you know, it's a kind of, you know, we're talking about price inflation now, but that's coming on the tail end of asset inflation. You know,
yeah.
Like how valuable can, you know, AMC really be? And that's part of it is like, you know, the power of retail stock investing is also not really well understood or I think theorized at this point, but it's clearly shaping this in a lot of ways and also shaping people's exposure to it. You know, I think that one thing I would really like to emphasize is that I think, you know, especially as it relates to crypto, there's just a whole lot that we don't know other than that, like, it is stitched together with bubble gum and being presented as like, you know, concrete. And that is, you know, when, I mean, that's, you know, that's sort of the ballgame when people are trying to raise money while doing that, you know, let alone sell a political campaign. I mean, to me, it's fairly frightening.
It's psychotic. But in terms of just like the volatility, we need to look no further than the example that you give at the start of your piece here, which is the Terra USD, or the, which is essentially the dollar peg for Luna. And a few months ago, Luna was essentially worthless, fell to $0 in value, something close to that. And the crypto industry essentially responded and dressed it up as a Ponzi scheme in order to continue to inflate the price of Luna and its stable coin as associated with it. Just take us through what happened there and, you know, how naked, frankly, what was the CEO's name? The guy who,
Do Kwon.
Yeah.
Do Kwon was like, he's like, do you want to be, he had been like one of those, like, oh, so you're poor. You want to be poor guys. When people would like criticize his business. No, I mean, in the case of Terra, you know, they offered Terra USD, basically their product was sort of the most, you know, it's a fairly humdrum proposition. We have this currency called Luna, and you will always be able to like withdraw it at like a dollar peg. And that's because the value of Luna is staked to this thing called Terra, which through a process called that we call a protocol can accrue value that we pay out. That is a marvelous way to disguise a Ponzi scheme, because you're basically saying, we will collect money in box A, as Sam Bankman-Fried memorably described it, and through a process that, you know, we're not really going to be able to describe other than to say that it rocks, we're going to add value to what's in A while taking the money that you're giving us to spend on things that will allow for even more money to come in and be put in box A. And now you may be wondering, like, what is Box B? Box B is, you know, alternative currencies and other, you know, offerings and things that you can do to continue to draw in, you know, investor interest. I think that, you know, again, there is no company in this space that has, like, established a business model that can justify that sort of, you know, money burning. Like, you know, to be clear, you know, venture capital, like, you can invest in, you know, Amazon lost money, obviously. But I mean, heck, like, you know, oil diggers and wildcatters have lost money all the time. It's a bit, you know, luck has a lot to do with it. But in this case, it's not about luck. It's just that, like, yeah, these people, like, it turns out that, like, investing in stuff that has, you know, when we talk about, like, why capitalism is kind of screwed or has failed, I mean, you know, we're looking at the failures, a big failure of it right here, which is just that, like, it can't efficiently allocate capital. You know, the roads you drive on suck. Our bridges fall apart. You can't get to work on time. You're probably never going to be able to own a house. But if you want to own an NFT of a Bored Ape for $200,000, you can. Like, that's a failure of capital, you know, resource allocation.
And I just want to say,
to me, is the key point.
Even the proposition that Luna begins with there, the fact that it has to be pegged to the value of a U.S. dollar in order to create stability for the people who want to buy this particular form of cryptocurrency, is that not just undercutting the entire premise of cryptocurrency from the outset of your proposition?
I think that they're not, like, there's a way in which I think, like, they're not even, like the set of first principles from which they believe that they operate is one where the, you know, because, like, again, like, investor community, like they have, like, all these, like, nomenclature, like FUD, that is just about explaining how, like, negative news, like negative feedback is a, you know, it's if anything, legitimation of the mission. Yeah. So, and, you know, investing also, this is also a case of other, like, oddball investing communities that, like, when value of your thing goes down, whether it's, like, silver or gold, you know, you will have people who will say, aha, it went down in the past before, and they will use some previous behavior and previous turn of the cycle that doesn't actually have any similarity in dynamic, but was just the last time, you know, the number went down, and say, well, you know, we know that, like, you know, what it looks like and how it rebuilds. And, you know, to me, that is the, you know, sort of, like, that kind of, like, if you're able to create that kind of cosmology in which, like, all flaws, all failures, just kind of get reabsorbed back into the, you know, belief of, like, ultimately forward motion, then, you know, all that has to do is, like, you have to figure out, well, what sustains that forward motion. And narratively speaking, you know, spending money on Super Bowl ads and shit is a great way to do that if you're not actually able to drum up business by investing in real things. Because marketing, you know, like tourism, is one of those things that you invest in when you don't actually want to, you know, build stable economies with well-paid individuals who could ultimately take charge of their own destiny.
And also, I mean, the fact that it so much of the money invested or bought in terms of the cryptocurrency here goes towards marketing in order to get more people to fulfill the multi-level marketing obligation in order to maintain the price of this coin. And you're not even really producing a good, right? Like, there, and it's all about celebrity spokespeople. It's just a trifecta of late stage capitalist indicators and bench points where nothing of value is being produced. Everything is inflating itself and entirely unstable. And it's just about a transferring and replicating dollar figures on a screen while really just stealing it from average people under the guise of, you can be a millionaire just like me. It's like, we are living, I know people have said that we're living in an age of widespread fraud, but is this example of it, I think, like, I know some people in the audience might be like, why do we focus on crypto so much? What's the point? This is the point. It's because it is a canary in the coal mine for the collapse of our financial system.
Right. I think that a good way to think about crypto and a reason to pay attention to crypto in particular is it's not like a, you know, it's not like the, in, you know, in the case of the housing market in, like, the 2000s that led to the great, you know, the financial crisis and the Great Recession. I think a really important, you know, point of departure, even though that was ultimately the product of many, probably some of the same loans that were caught up in the SNL crisis in the 80s, I think that you can see in the SNL, in the financial crisis with those, you know, home loans, you know, it's not like the home loan market was not that big. It was, you know, but it led to, like, you know, these, you know, like trillions of dollars in consequences. Why? Well, because there were a whole lot of bets that were built on it that ultimately represented a lot of value that was accounted for that shouldn't have been there. And that, you know, is another kind of allocation crisis, I would argue. And I think with the crypto, in the case of crypto, you know, it's not a big number yet, as far as we know. Like, even if everything were to fail, but, you know, I think for a lot of people, like, huh, like, you, every, a lot of people know, so individuals who have exposure. We just went through and we're still going through the shocks of GameStop and AMC, where you have these companies, large market cap companies, that are basically propped up for no good reason other than, like, you know, like some, like, you know, like indescribable investor, you know, internet interest at the moment. And the meme stock phenomenon, where you have this thing untethered from value, I think, to me, you know, that's where Joe Weisenthal and Oddlots has made this connection too. Like, the power of retail does allow for things to grow, perhaps when they shouldn't, in value. And in the case of crypto, it may be enough to help grow it past your critical mass, where, you know, like, yeah, you, like, we know, like, everybody individually knows a bunch of people who are exposed, and those people are represented in Congress by people who are susceptible to pressure. I mean, Kirsten Gillibrand, who, by the way, ran for president all that long ago, is, you know, pimping legislation in the Senate right now, hoping to, you know, effectively regulate crypto as a commodity and, you know, thus effectively insulating it from the most important kinds of regulation that it would need to face. You know, in general, I think that if we're to kind of, I guess, look, sort of, you know, develop an idea of, like, well, what is to be done then if this whole thing is a scam, et cetera. You know, it's got to be, like, I think the crypto thing will only get resolved with the same set of, you know, broader, broader resolution that's going to be able to make, you know, like substantially unstick our politics. Largely because increasingly, you know, if crypto is able to entwine itself with the political system and then go to zero, you know, much like in the case of the SNLs, it may end up being tied to another, you know, a transition from one political order to another. And in the case of, you know, I think a lot of the way historians view it now, in the case of the 1980s and 1990s, it's, you know, that was the moment of neoliberal takeoff. Especially when it was assured that the stock market surely wasn't going to be eating the SNL crisis. It was going to be the federal government.
Well, I wish I could keep you here for even longer, but before I let you go, I want to talk a bit about Blowback, because yes, we're in season three. Season one, Iraq War. Season two, Cuba. Season three, Korea. Why'd you choose Korea? Just, did you feel that it was, you know, well, one, it's, I think, instructive for Cold War and communism versus capitalism purposes, but like, I thought when I saw that you were doing season three, I was like, I bet they're going to do Vietnam. And you went with Korea. So what went into that decision?
I think Brendan and I both were pretty inspired by the idea of going something that, like, people really didn't know much about, period, including us. It also is, I think, a, you know, just on its own, once you even read the first little bit about it, there, like, the significance of it becomes clear, both just in terms of the horrible casualty count that we inflicted, the explanation that it offers, you know, as an alternative to the mainstream narrative about why North Korea is the way that it is. And then I think, you know, kind of lastly, and, you know, when we look at, like, the structure of American society after World War II, you know, the Korean War was in a lot of ways the, you know, conflict that allowed the American elite and ruling class to help consolidate their control and make sure that the trajectory of America into the rest of the 20th century was one that was, you know, on a Cold War footing. And there's a, you know, I in just researching it, you find that, like, you know, I mean, we could have made five podcast seasons about this subject, just like we probably could every other subject that we're interested in. But in this case, it felt, you know, just the more that we looked at it, like, oh, yeah, this is a very obvious thing that I think our listeners would also both like to know more about and find a lot interesting in what we found interesting in it.
All right. Well, everyone should check out Blowback Podcast, and you can find it on Stitcher. I listened to the first episode.
Well, no, we have a different system this year.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Okay, so what is the different system?
We are on Supporting Cast, so if you want to subscribe, go to blowback.supportingcast.fm. And then we will begin the main narrative episodes for season 3. They will begin to go public on October 1st. But if you want to listen to the whole thing now, ad-free, go to blowback.supportingcast.fm. It's $25. You get 20 episodes and a whole bunch of other stuff. More details there. Check it out.
Damn, 20 episodes this time.
Mm-hmm. Bonus episodes all at once.
Wow. All right. Well, awesome stuff. I really couldn't recommend it more highly. Check out Blowback. Thank you so much. This Noah Colwin, contributing editor at Jewish Currents, co-host of Blowback. And you can read the piece on crypto that we talked about today in the Baffler called Tales from the Thrifts. Thanks so much for your time today, Noah. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Emma. Thanks for having me.
Of course. All right. With that said, we are going to head into the fun half. But first, Matt, what is happening on Left Reckoning?
Tonight, I will be doing a Lex stream with Josh, talk I had about ayahuasca with Joshua Con Russell. And also, there will be a Left Reckoning. This is Reckoning Left Revolution. This is Revolution, our crossover Thursday, bi-monthly crossover with This is Revolution. Griscom and I will be talking to Pascal and Jason about some different news stories tonight. That's at 9 Eastern time. So subscribe to This is Revolution Left Reckoning on YouTube to get that.
Nice.
This is Left Revolution. Sorry.
Show your face, Bradley. Pay for what you've said. Do we have Brandon?
Yeah, we're bringing Brandon in now. You can unmute Brandon.
Hello.
Hello. We don't have Matt, right?
Binder is actually out today.
Yeah, it was his birthday the other day, and I saw he was on birthday, vacation. Binder. So happy birthday to Matt Binder. Check out Joom. Check out Scam Economy, which was relevant today. And on the discourse, Brandon, what's happening?
Yeah, we have a new episode up on the Patreon from last week where we talk about the raid on Donald Trump's winter White House. And we should have a new episode up for you this weekend on the SoundCloud. So, you know, big things happening. Not for us, but I assume somewhere.
That's a safe bet. All right. Well, with that, we're going to head into the fun half. Take your calls, read some IMs. 646-257-3920. See you there.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What?
What is that going on? It's nuts! Wait a second. Hold on for a second. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who?
What is up, everyone?
Nomi Key.
You did it. Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this,
7-8?
Yes.
Hi, me? You're safe?
Yes.
Is it me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No, stop. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go for that.
You libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-3551. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less.
But let me say this.
Poop.
You call it satire. Sam goes, satire.
On top of it all?
Yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt.
Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late. And the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.